Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Civil societies around the world and voluntarism in America, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Later in the program, historian Ann Firer Scott of Duke University discusses her new history of women's voluntary associations in the United States. Since the beginning of the 1990s, the world's geographical and ideological maps have changed continuously and unpredictably. Underscoring much of this ferment was the idea of a civil society, the space between the individual and the state, those autonomous networks in education, the arts, and religion that motivate political transformation. During a recent conference, the National Humanities Center invited an international group of scholars, politicians, diplomats, and journalists to consider civil societies around the world. According to the center's director, Robert Connor, the concept of a civil society is as old as the Greeks, but as urgent as today's headlines.
Wayne, I started off with this project thinking that the fact that the phrase civil society had been used a lot in Central and Eastern Europe in the years following 89, when the great changes were taking place there, provided an opportunity for opening up some dialogue with the intellectuals and the scholars and others in that part of the world who had done so much to advance the cause of freedom. And that was an opportunity for us to form some very positive relationships with them. But as the work went on, I realized that it was much more than that. It was an idea that had resonance throughout the globe, and an idea of such historical and philosophical significance that we just needed to turn our attention to it very seriously.
Give me a take on the idea of a civil society in terms of this polarity or this interplay between that which is the individual and that which is the state. The civil society is somewhere in between.
Precisely. It's that one way of looking at it is to think of it as the space between the individual and the state, and thereby the intermediary organizations, the associations that bind individuals together, but which are not dictated or controlled either by radical self-seeking individualism or by state control. And what appears to have happened in a lot of countries is that space has suddenly opened up. It's opened up in part because of the failure of some of the Marxist-Leninist regimes. And it's opened up, I think, in a wider sense as we've tried to rethink what the limits and the effectiveness of the state might be in the circumstances of the late 20th century.
Are we right to assume that the West is doing the teaching and that what used to be called Eastern Europe, or regardless of the point on the map where we're talking about the failure of totalitarianism and the failure of statist regimes, the rise of the civil society, are we right to assume that we're the ones who are going to be doing all the teaching here?
I don't assume that at all. There's something that amused me very much in the conference. The discussions that went on here at the National Humanities Center on this topic very often found the speakers from outside the United States saying strongly, look, the legacy, the intellectual legacy, the experience of American Constitution, of the Founding Fathers and so on, the United States have been immensely important to them in their reconceptualization of how their countries should function. Americans, I think, are very cautious about that, and understandably so. I don't think we want to be in the position of saying that we have the perfect regime, the perfect government that's going to provide the model for everybody else.
One of the things on the minds of academics these days, Bob Connor, apropos of your comments here on the civil society, is that the only universal thing about politics is that it's local. Is that a contradiction or, in fact, a sort of a complementary line, a continuity here when we think about the civil society?
Well, I think it's a point of considerable struggle right at the moment. That is, the idea of a civil society certainly has applications in a very wide number of local settings. And I think there's a lot for us to learn from the way in which it's operated in quite diverse settings. So we have something to learn from what's happened in Central and Eastern Europe, and they have some things to learn from American and Latin American experience. At the same time, whatever emerges within a society, I think quite clearly has to be rooted in local traditions. And the attempt to try to understand how you reconcile local values, local traditions, with the more general demands of a civil society, including some universal human rights, is one of the tough issues that we're struggling with.
Here we are, Bob Connor, recording this conversation as the new year has just dawned. And as we look at the headlines, we don't always see happy news about ethnic conflict, about ethnic troubles. I'm thinking particularly in what used to be the Soviet Union. Are we talking really here about human nature or politics? Can we be at all hopeful about the idea of a civil society pulling together these regimes, these constituencies that appear to be in such deep conflict, apart from the fact that they no longer have to live under the thumb of communism?
Well, I think what we're seeing in part, Wayne, is the effects of an ideological vacuum. That as many of the dominating ideas that shaped not only the Marxist regimes, but many of those in the West as well, have disintegrated in the last few years, what is available to replace those ideas? What's around? You have a vacuum, and into that vacuum flows a lot of nonsense and a lot of very rabid, very dangerous views, and including some very rabid forms of nationalism. So I think the issue, as I see it, is in part the development of alternative views, alternative ways of viewing the world that can substitute for some of the things that were provided by the old certainties that have now dissolved.
You, before you came to the National Humanities Center, Bob Connor, made your living as a classics scholar. You have the long and the short view of the idea of a civil society. Talk to me for a few moments about the Greeks. Are we talking about anachronisms here? Are we talking about analogies that look good to academics but don't really make a difference in the real world?
Well, I don't think the analogies are so important. I think the Greeks understood one very, very important thing on this whole issue of the way in which individuals relate to a larger part of the society. And that is that the role of the citizen was absolutely crucial. And it was crucial not only for the proper functioning of political life, but it was also crucial for the kind of satisfaction, the kind of happiness which individuals achieve. So when Aristotle says something like, traditional translation for it is, man is by nature a political being or a political animal, he doesn't mean males specifically. And he doesn't mean by that political in some sense of constantly having to be engaged in petition writing or legislative activity. Mm-hmm. He means much more that being a citizen, with all the things that citizenship implies, is crucial for the way in which this kind of creature that we are really functions happily. Now, I think that insight of Aristotle just remains immensely valid, immensely important when we talk about a civil society. We're really talking about a citizen society. And we're talking about citizens who get satisfactions from their role, not only in seeing their political life run properly, but that all sorts of other associations within it, religious ones, voluntary ones, trade unions, manufacturer associations, all these other independent private institutions run well as well.
It's a bit of an irony, isn't it, Bob, that here as we sit in the United States and look at these societies that are reconstituting themselves around the world, there are people within our borders who tell us that our own civil society, that we really never really had one, that we had a bit of an experiment in Republican democracy, and that if it hasn't failed, it is failing, that our people no longer have a sense of being citizens. I mean, you have this sort of quaint language about civics courses that most citizens would look at and say, yuck, I don't want to know about that. It's not part of the way I conduct my life. Is that too pessimistic?
Well, I think it is. I think there are great problems that come about in the kind of scale, the kind of anonymity of the organizations that we have in a society this size, and the difficulties, and there's just unquestionably a number of obstacles to our achieving a fully civil society in the United States. But the health of American institutions, in part certainly of intellectual institutions that can help us think our way through this, and of other kinds of institutions in the United States, is strong. And I'm certainly not pessimistic.
Well, here we're about to listen to Ann Scott from Duke University talk to us about women's voluntary associations. There's a good bit of evidence there to the contrary, that is to say on the rather positive side of the ledger. Let me be a little more limited in a last question to you, Bob Connor. We're about to embark on a seminar here at the Humanities Center on the idea of a civil society. Are we going to have a bunch of angels dancing on the heads of pins? What do you really expect to come out of this enterprise?
Well, I would hope a number of things. First off, the idea is one with a rich history and philosophical tradition behind it. We need to understand it better. We need to rearticulate it in terms of the setting of contemporary societies. And if we can make a modest contribution to that, I would be very happy indeed. And I think there's a potential in this idea for forms of dialogue that bring people together with effects that can be felt in a lot of other areas. It has a potential for spanning geographical divides, because we've seen that the discussion of the idea is a very important factor, both in Latin America, in parts of Asia, in parts of Africa, and certainly in parts of Europe as well. So I think it has an opportunity to open up some dialogues that very much need to be opened up.
Bob Connor, it's always a pleasure to have you on Soundings. You're the director of the National Humanities Center. We're about to embark on this long-term seminar on the idea of a civil society. Thanks for stopping by, and good luck in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Join me now for a conversation about the history of women's voluntary associations in the United States. I'll talk with Ann Firer Scott of Duke University. Her new book is Natural Allies. The subtitle is Women's Associations in American History. According to Ann Scott, when women began to form benevolent societies in colonial America, they exercised public roles despite institutional constraints from the state and the church. In doing so, they not only improved education and culture in the new nation, they also moved beyond the so-called women's sphere. But voluntarism is by no means a thing of the past. The Gallup poll indicates that more than half of American adults regularly perform some form of voluntary work in their communities. Ann Scott's new book, Natural Allies, narrates the central role of women in the development of voluntarism in America. Natural Allies is available from the University of Illinois Press. Reading from her book, Ann Firer Scott.
When six single and five married women of Boston's leading families met in October 1812 to form what they decided to call the Fragment Society, it's doubtful that they saw themselves as part of a great national movement bringing women into public life, and still more doubtful that they thought of themselves as beginning to influence the social history of their community.
Your book is Natural Allies, Ann Scott. Why are women's voluntary organizations important to an understanding of American democracy? That's a pretty big claim, isn't it?
It is a big claim, but it is if you stop to think about it. Let me just ask you, Wayne, suppose that all the women in this community who are doing voluntary activity were to go home and sit on their hands for 2 weeks. How many things can you think of that would cease to exist?
That would fall apart. How far back do we take this? Your book?
The end of the 18th century.
Uh-huh.
Probably goes further back than that, but at least the records that are available begin in the 18th century.
Is it important that we know, Ann Scott, the name and the organization of the very first of these women's voluntary associations?
It doesn't make the slightest difference, because the early ones were very, very similar. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, the embarrassing moment last week, I found one earlier than the first one I deal with in this book, but the name was very similar, and the only thing is they had 17 volumes of records. I was sorry I hadn't found it sooner.
Well, now, out of all of these thousands, millions of women who participated in voluntary associations from, you know, before the country formed itself, right up to the present day,
right,
do you find common threads? Do you find common characteristics? What goes on?
Well, probably there is a common personality, the kind of person who's willing to join with other people to get things done. At certain points, you find commonalities in class and in social experience and location and so on. But actually, there's been some kind of voluntary association formed among almost any kind of American woman you can think of. Uh-huh. Because right now, of course, there's a tremendous amount of activity in housing projects among women who are not terribly well-educated, but who are determined to get the drugs out of their housing projects.
Do the women's voluntary associations, Ann Scott, that you write about in Natural Allies, do they have necessary partisan components, or when do they begin to assume
those
characters?
Are you talking about political parties?
Yeah, I'm talking about Republicans and Democrats conservatives and liberals.
Well, you see, the thing about the voluntary association as a social institution, it mm-hmm. can be applied to any purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the KKK could have a women's auxiliary. So it's not the content, but the fact of this is that we get together and we work together in an all-female association.
Tell me about some of these associations. Let me just give you a partial list to choose from here. The YWCA, the AAUW, the WCTU, sounds like a bunch of radio stations, DAR, the National Council of Jewish Women, the Mormons Relief Society.
Look at the divergence of the list that you've given me. The YWCA began as a very religious group for young women, and gradually evolved toward being a cross-class effort to help working-class women. Mm-hmm. The AAUW, on the other hand, didn't come along until much later. It was organized as the Association of Collegiate Alumni because the young women in the first generation of college graduates found that people didn't want to have anything to do with them because they'd done this radical thing of going to college. So they joined together in self-protection,
right,
and have become, of course, a major force in American educational life.
Well, let's pause on that word, education. Let me ask you to speculate as a historian, Ann Scott. We wouldn't have what we have as an educational institution in this country without these women's voluntary associations.
The educational scene would be very different if the women's associations had not from early on been interested in primary education, in secondary education, and of course in the education of women.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly all the women's colleges were the early women's colleges were the result of effort on the part of women's associations.
And tell me about the Civil War. I mean, let's turn to the organization of your book here. Why is that important? Why that's a sort of
absolutely a critical moment because Clara Barton said one time that the Civil War was worth 50 years of peacetime as far as women were concerned. But what happened was that women took the skills that they had been developing for half a century in these voluntary associations into the public world when they began to form their soldiers' aid societies and did a tremendous amount of the medical care and providing what they called amenities for the soldiers. But in the South, of course, they did essential mm-hmm. Preparation of tents and uniforms and clothing and medicine. And this was all valued at last. They'd been doing this kind of thing for a long time.
But you had to have this catalyst.
The men noticed.
Uh-huh.
One of the funniest things is to hear the men talking. My, they say, why, that woman, she could be a great merchant. Look at the way she's running this thing. Well, she'd been doing things like that in her benevolent society for mm-hmm. years, but they never noticed.
The 19th century, at some point here in your book, Natural Allies, Ann Scott, you point out the 19th century was called the woman's century. Have we come, I mean no disrespect when I say, how far, baby, have we come?
Well, we've come a long way, but we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
I mean, if you ask any woman that you know who's well-informed historically, if she would like to go back and live in 1820, I don't think you're going to find many takers.
No way.
But, it struck the contemporaries, the males of the 19th century were struck by the emergence of women into public life.
You write about a form of separatism that grew up in the country. You talk about the little republics. That's a wonderful phrase to characterize these voluntary associations. Are we essentially stuck with that, Ann Scott? I mean, you know, the women on the one side, the men on the other. Not necessarily an adversarial relationship,
but
difference.
No. As a matter of fact, you begin to find much more cooperation by about 1900.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first century, women very much used their own all-female associations. By the turn of the century, and particularly about, say, 1910, you begin to find many more organizations where men and women are able to work together. And, of course, we do now. the things that you and I belong to are very, very few of them are all male or all female.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a Mason or?
Nope.
I'm a member of the AUW, but mm-hmm. by and large, we now have much more cooperation.
And Scott, what does a very large word like race have to do with the creation of women's voluntary associations?
Well, this was one of the things that I learned in the process of doing this book. When I first began working on it, I was working on white women's associations. And it was then I became aware that there's a parallel structure beginning again in the late 18th century. There's a parallel structure of black women's associations from the very beginning. And it's very rare for the two groups to meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, is a tragedy.
You mean the black and white women?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
If they had only crossed that barrier, the racial barrier, and worked together in critical moments, I think particularly in the days of Reconstruction, but also in the late 19th century when we had this awful period that the black historians call the nadir,
mm-hmm.
when lynching was on the rampage and blacks were being discriminated against in every possible way. If the white women had joined with the black women at that time, they could have changed the situation, instead of which the white women were afraid.
How did the men who ran the country respond to these women's voluntary associations, regardless of the color of the person who was doing the volunteering and the associating?
Well, I think the politicians responded quite a lot, as you can see from some of the data in the book, that the things that women were able to accomplish, mm-hmm. particularly at the local level. And this is true of the black women as well as the white women, although the black women had a much more difficult time getting a political hearing. You take the city of Atlanta, for example, where there's a flourishing black women's organization called the Atlanta Neighborhood Union. The city government took the position, well, let them do it, instead of saying, well, they're doing so well, now we will help them with their mm-hmm. schools and their hospitals and so on. It's really a tragic story. But in any event, every part of the country had its associations, and the South, which is, you know, was much more in the early 19th century, is very rural and not many centers of population, also had an astonishing number of such associations, and many, many, many in the Civil War.
When do we begin to associate a word like feminism or activism or progressive politics,
well,
you know, with these women's voluntary associations?
Activism begins in the 1820s. Progressivism is the label put on the efforts that were made, say, from about 1885 to 1912.
Mm-hmm.
And feminism as a word doesn't come into the language until the turn of the 20th century.
Do you think that was a handicap for the kinds of progress that these associations could make, that it assumed a necessary kind of ideological baggage and therefore became popularly suspect?
I don't think it had any. Well, strong-minded women, that was the label that was put on the suffragists. But actually, I don't think there was a great deal of opposition to a lot of what women's organizations were doing. They were doing very useful things having to do with education, having to do with public health,
mm-hmm.
having to do with things like playgrounds, having to do with bringing art and music into the schools, having lunch program.
These are reflections of what goes through the minds of women when they think about their children. They think about the welfare of their children, and we generalize from that small circle.
Well, as a matter of fact, the rationale for about 90% of what women do is motherhood. We're doing this as mothers. Whether they really are, or whether this is just a convenient, what the CIA calls cover, I don't know. But the fact is that this is the rationale. This is often, the suffragists not so much. The suffragists talk more about natural rights and also about the fact that women would clean up the mess, which alas we haven't done.
This phrase you just used, Ann Scott, natural rights. How much of this book that you've written, Natural Allies, is theoretical? I mean, how do you treat the question of, you know, I mean, back in the 19th century, there were serious, straight-faced debates about whether women had minds, in fact.
Or souls.
Or souls. How much of this theorizing do you go in for here?
I don't get much into ideology. I have a propensity for the concrete. Such theoretical analysis as is here has been dragged out of me by my younger colleagues and my husband.
Fair enough. Ann Scott, again, your book is Natural Allies. Does this word natural have anything to do with the notion of biology as destiny?
No. I'll tell you the truth. I wanted a good, catchy title, and so I got Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, and I looked up women in the index.
You quote from some dead white male in the beginning here, don't you, Euripides?
I found that Euripides had said, woman is woman's natural ally, and I thought, there's my title. There is no hidden agenda. There is no underlying theory. It's just a catchy title.
What do you see for the future? I know that you historians don't like to deal with crystal balls and that sort of thing, but given the past, given the rich history of women's voluntary associations.
The conventional wisdom is that so many women are working now that voluntary associations are going to die. Huh. But I don't think so for two reasons. For one thing, the voluntary effort is moving into another economic and social group so that we find many women working, as I think I mentioned earlier, in housing projects and places like that. But secondly, so many people are retiring early now, or retiring in good health, good spirits, that I see a whole range of new opportunity for people over 55 who are moving into voluntary jobs because they've had a career. Now they're doing something different.
Mm-hmm. Ann Scott, thanks for coming by to participate on Soundings. Your book is Natural Allies, the University of Illinois Press. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you, Wayne. It's always a pleasure to be here. I hope lots of people are going to read this book.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to the second program in a series of discussions about the idea of a civil society. The speakers were Ann Firer Scott of Duke University and Robert Connor of the National Humanities Center. If you'd like a cassette copy of their comments, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 599. That's program number 599, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, philosophy and politics. Join me for conversations featuring Richard Rorty of the University of Virginia and Thomas Flynn of Emory University. Richard Rorty will talk about philosophy and the politics of the American left. Thomas Flynn will discuss the life and work of the French historian and philosopher Michel Foucault. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Civil Societies and Voluntarism in America, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Robert Connor, the center's director, discusses the world's changing ideological maps and the idea of civil societies, the web of voluntarism between the individual and the state that accounts for much recent political transformation. Ann Scott of Duke University discusses her new history of women's voluntary associations in the United States. Civil Societies and Voluntarism in America. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.